Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Lots of breaking news today. The Obama administration has given the green light to the country's first offshore wind farm. It'll be here in Massachusetts between Cape Cod and Nantucket Island. We'll have a full report a little later in the program. But first, Republicans and one Democrat have for a third time blocked debate on the financial reform bill in a test vote on opening debate. Here's what Democrat Frank Lautenberg of New Jersey had to say to Republicans minutes after the roll call.
Whose side are you on? Who do you work for? On Monday, Tuesday, and again today, we got an answer. On the other side of the aisle, they made it clear. They stand with the big banks.
Gail Chadwick is Capitol Hill correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, we'll get to the Republicans' response to that kind of accusation, but what stood out for you in this vote today?
I think the fact that nothing changed. The vote looks a little bit different in that Senator Reid switched his vote at the last minute. That's a procedural move. He voted with the Republicans. That allows him to bring back the vote at any point. And I just got off a discussion with the Deputy Majority Leader who said he intends to hold the Senate in session all night long so that the American people can see that Republicans are standing with Wall Street and Democrats are standing with Main Street. We want to make it clear to the people of this country that Wall Street lobbyists are controlling this vote, he said.
Are you talking about a good old-fashioned filibuster?
Well, it's not a filibuster exactly, but it is a lot of talking all night long and possibly punctuated with more votes. So it'll look and feel like a filibuster, but not quite. It's actually a procedural move to prevent a filibuster.
Well, okay, we'll follow that. But meanwhile, we hear this accusation. The Democrats say the Republicans and the one Democrat who sided with them are with the big banks. Republicans have been saying that they don't think that the bill goes far enough. Does this put them in an interesting position? Republicans have been making great gains with the Tea Party crowd, calling for less government. Are they now calling for more?
Well, it's interesting. They are picking their shots very carefully. They do not want a government, what they say is a government bailout with a new consumer protection agency. That's the main thing. They are making the case that this is going to hurt. Today they were telling me Snickers, candy bars, dentists, auto dealers, small businesses will be hurt by a new agency that could have a very broad reach.
Have to tell us how it will hurt Snickers.
He didn't elaborate, but any organization that gives credit to any of their consumers could come under the new regulation.
And of course, we should say Democrats would say that's the point.
Exactly. Yeah. And that is what they're saying. Yeah. Everything that the Republicans want to do is weaken the bill, with one important exception. Republicans are saying to Democrats, why aren't you doing anything with Fannie and Freddie, the public-private enterprises in housing that started the problem to begin with?
And they want more regulation of those two mortgage giants.
Or have them completely dissolved. But address it. And Democrats are telling me, look, that's a big issue. We will get to it, but not on this bill. However, if it comes to the floor with an amendment, we'll see a vote on it.
By the way, you mentioned Republicans they've come out with their own proposal. It includes an outright ban on bailouts. Democrats are saying that their proposal would, in essence, do that by making banks put into a fund, contribute to a fund, so that in the event that a company is failing, the payment for that would come out of the fund as opposed to being paid for by taxpayers. But obviously the Republicans don't feel that's enough.
No. The one thing that people are completely agreed on is that the American public hates bailouts, and anyone that can tag the other side with bailouts has a winning hand. Honestly, I don't think it's clear that the GOP plan does anything more or less than the Democrats on that front yet.
Gail Chadwick, we just have about a minute left. Did you see any impact of yesterday's grilling of Goldman Sachs on today's vote?
I did. There certainly is a sense among Republicans that banks did not look good in that moment. And there is a push for more transparency. It's interesting. I just spoke with Bernie Sanders, a Democrat from Vermont, probably the farthest left member in the Democratic caucus. He's proposing an amendment that has lots of Republican support that would push for more transparency, especially on the issue of who the Fed loaned all of that interest-free money to. And that is, I think, an issue that cuts across both parties.
Well, and Lloyd Blankfein obviously felt that his job security isn't an issue after yesterday. He was asked by ABC if he thought he would lose his job. He said no. And you noted to us earlier today that their stock went up. So there you go. Gail Chadwick, Capitol Hill correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, on what may be a very late night in Washington as Democrats force some sort of floor debate on financial reform. Gail, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Remember the anthrax attacks in the days after 9/11? Letters containing the dangerous bacteria were mailed to news organizations and the Senate offices of Democrats Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy. They were postmarked Trenton, New Jersey, and those letters bore the return address of a non-existent school in Franklin Park, New Jersey. Five people died. More than a dozen got sick. So who did it? The FBI closed its investigation earlier this year without ever charging anyone. But before that, they'd focused on two suspects. One committed suicide. The other didn't. But when you read what he went through, you wonder how he didn't. Stephen Hatfill was the first suspect in the anthrax case. He was eventually cleared of any wrongdoing. Now, many of you who followed this story already know that, but we mention it again because the fact that he was so innocent makes his story even more powerful. Journalist David Fried tells it in the May issue of The Atlantic. He joins us now. David, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And help us a little more in placing this in time, because nerves were really on edge.
The allegations against Stephen Hatfill occurred within weeks after the attacks of 9/11. He had been a researcher for the government for a number of years, and in the process had accrued any number of political enemies as well as friends. And when the anthrax letters were mailed out and people began to die, the FBI was called in. There was a frantic effort to try to determine who was responsible for those mailings. And in fairly short order, Stephen Hatfill's name came up.
And remember, the letters went to NBC News, the New York Post, the publisher of some tabloids, and the two lawmakers we mentioned. By the way, how did the people die who died? How'd they come in contact with the anthrax?
In a couple of instances, it was not really clear. There was an elderly woman who they theorized had contracted anthrax from her mail. There was a mail clerk in Manhattan who died who they never could determine what the correlation was. Two postal workers in Washington had apparently direct exposure to anthrax via the mail, and they died.
Well, and so there was heightened nervousness anyway post 9/11, and now there's near panic. I mean, we remember the reporting of this, and a sense that somebody had to be found so that the letters were stopped, not just to blame somebody, but to stop possible future letters. And as you say, they come to Stephen Hatfill. Give us a thumbnail of Stephen Hatfill. Who was he?
Stephen Hatfill was a virologist by training as well as a physician. He had spent his entire career researching diseases that afflict third world populations. And he worked in proximity to, though never worked directly with, materials such as anthrax. And there was an extrapolation made in the process of the FBI's investigation that somehow he had acquired anthrax stores and that he was responsible for having mailed out these spores.
Well, and we should say a little more about who he was, because it's fascinating. He sort of came up in an unusual way. He wanted to help people. He had this vague notion that he wanted to help people in the developing world. And so around college time, he went to the Congo and he learned, as you write, blood chemistry, parasitology, basic hematology in a rudimentary lab there. And he worked as a security guard at a radiator factory. He fought with the Rhodesian army. In fact, that leads to one of the suspicions about him. He was on an antibiotic called Cipro. Explain why that became of concern to FBI officials.
He had broken his nose badly while serving with the Rhodesian Army as a volunteer medic, and had problems breathing for years and years, and ultimately decided to have sinus surgery, and it just happened to have coincided with the 9/11 attacks. So one of the bits of incriminating evidence that the FBI perceived was that because he was taking Cipro, which is commonly used to combat anthrax, there was a surmise on the FBI's part that he had essentially girded himself from infection himself, when in fact it was just merely coincidence. And, you know, you can argue that the allegations of his Cipro use were really a metaphor for many of the other bits of so-called evidence that were used against him to imply that he was responsible for the anthrax murders.
But as you mentioned, the other thing that drew people to him, he was working at this U.S. military lab, USAMRIID.
USAMRIID,
for
short.
He was making less than $50,000 a year studying Ebola and other illnesses. But when you read this list as it starts to grow, these little things, working at this military lab, taking Cipro, when he was in Rhodesia fighting, there was a suburb nearby. Tell us why that was of note.
There is a suburb there called Greendale, and some of the letters that were sent to Capitol Hill with anthrax in them did have a return address of a Greendale school in New Jersey. The coincidence of that was more than curious as far as the FBI was concerned, and there were any number of other coincidences they considered and concluded cumulatively that they all pointed to the Stephen Hatfield's guilt.
Well, here's a couple more. Hatfield was in Britain and Florida, respectively, when two letters with fake anthrax were mailed from those locations. His girlfriend was Malaysian-born. A hoax package had been sent from Malaysia. You know, when you put the list together, David, could you at all see how officials might have thought, this is the guy?
Absolutely. But I think this is sort of the antithesis to the theory that if it walks like a duck and it talks like a duck, it's a duck. In this case, it wasn't a duck. All of the circumstantial evidence that the FBI amassed in reality amounted to nothing. Yet, cumulatively speaking, the FBI concluded that it all painted a picture of a man who was very guilty.
Well, and they were constantly being pushed to think that by two other people that enter into your story. One was Don Foster. He was a researcher who had helped officials in the past, and he dug up an unpublished novel that Hatfield had written about a fictional bioterror attack. So there's another thing that officials had. And then there was Barbara Hatch Rosenberg.
Barbara Hatch Rosenberg was an academic and a scientist who'd served as a low-level advisor to Bill Clinton on bioterrorism matters. And she had unilaterally and independently decided to take a look at the anthrax case. Ultimately, Barbara Hatch Rosenberg was granted an audience with Senate staffers and FBI officials, where she laid out her case. And a week later, FBI agents then searched Stephen Hatfield's apartment.
On national television.
Right. The national press was, in some fashion, notified of this search, and the explanation was simply that, gee, there must have been a leak.
From that meeting in Congress with senators and agents. Well, ultimately, Stephen Hatfield was put under such intense surveillance, he loses his job, he moves into his girlfriend's apartment, doesn't leave for 2 years, starts drinking, almost loses his mind. Then, years later, another suspect surfaces. David Fried's story about Stephen Hatfield appears in The Atlantic. We'll have more in a minute. And later today, the Obama administration has okayed the country's first wind farm project. It'll be located between Cape Cod and Nantucket Island here in Massachusetts. There are bound to be lawsuits, but we'll speak to the president of Cape Wind about winning, at least for today, his 9-year battle. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with David Fried. His story about Stephen Hatfield, the first suspect in that case of the deadly anthrax letters mailed in the days after the 9/11 attacks, appears in The Atlantic. And David, you write about how the FBI hounded Stephen Hatfield for 2 years without ever charging him. But Hatfield says the media also played a role, that they became stooges of the FBI, printing whatever leaks they got. This includes Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times, who has since apologized to Hatfield. But what did he write?
Christoph didn't use Hatfield's name initially. He labeled him with a very sinister-sounding moniker, Mr. Z, and implied that Mr. Z had access to some sort of secret hideout in the Virginia countryside where conceivably he could have put together his anthrax mailings, and any number of allegations that really were groundless.
You asked Hatfield at some point, did he want to kill himself? What did he say?
He stared straight ahead, and you could see the muscles in his jaw working. And he insisted that he never once considered suicide because he recognized that if he did, in fact, kill himself, he would be forever branded guilty, much like Bruce Ivins has been. In truth, in talking to friends of his and former colleagues, there's no question that there was a broad concern at the time that he might do just that, given the pressure that he was facing from both the FBI and the news media.
You mentioned Bruce Ivins. After a while, Steve Hatfield, the attention just sort of shifts from him, and it swings over to Bruce Ivins. Who was he?
Bruce Ivins was a researcher at USAMRID, which is where Stephen Hatfield had worked, and Bruce Ivins was arguably Mr. Anthrax. He had spent his entire career studying anthrax, researching anthrax, refining vaccines for anthrax. I think it's safe to say that of the small universe of potential suspects in this case, he arguably was at the top of the list.
Well, then what happened? I mean, you tell us that at one point Bruce Ivins was actually consulting with the FBI, and you also write about, I think someone called it detective myopia. Was Bruce Ivins just right in front of their face, but people were telling them so many things about Steve Hatfield that that's where they looked?
There's a phenomenon in law enforcement. Actually, Daryl Gates, before he passed away, we talked about this, and he felt that this was a classic case of detective myopia, where as an investigator, you become so fixated on the suspect that you lose sight of the veracity and the objectivity of the evidence that you're presented. And so even though the more likely and more logical suspect would be someone who had spent his career working with anthrax as opposed to someone who had never worked with anthrax, they continued to pursue Stephen Hatfield to the exclusion of other viable suspects, including Bruce Ivins.
And you mentioned Daryl Gates. He was the former L.A. police chief, and as you said, he's passed away. As has Bruce Ivins, the second suspect. There was mounting evidence against him, and he did take his life.
There was no question the evidence against Ivins was substantially more tangible than any of the evidence that was ever presented against Stephen Hatfield. Most notably was the fact that the FBI, as they proceeded with their investigation, were able to determine that the anthrax spores that had been sent out in the mail bore a direct DNA correlation to the anthrax that was solely in Bruce Ivins' possession. That alone would, I think, raise considerable suspicion that Bruce Ivins was responsible for the mailings. But there were many other instances that would confirm that suspicion. He had worked in his lab, for example, very late at night alone in the days and the weeks prior to the anthrax mailings with no rational explanation as to why he was there. He presented to the FBI in the course of their investigation allegedly misleading data to theoretically throw the investigating agents off of his trail. There was also evidence to suggest that Bruce Ivins was mentally imbalanced.
But you know, David, even his lawyer, even Bruce Ivins' lawyer confirms that he did have psychiatric problems long before he was being hounded by the FBI. But when you start reading about him, or I'm hearing you now talk about him, after having heard the whisper campaigns against the first suspect, Steve Hatfield, you find yourself thinking, I wonder if that's true.
This may be one of those cases where the debate will rage in perpetuity, but I do think it's safe to say, all things considered, Stephen Hatfield was not the anthrax murderer.
Well, others felt the same way. He sued the Justice Department. They settled. How much did he get?
Hatfield received something on the order of slightly less than $6 million from the Justice Department. And the interesting thing is he has committed about $1.5 million to building a boat, a floating laboratory. It's his dream to be able to sail this floating laboratory up the Amazon in search of rare and undiscovered plants from which he hopes to synthesize new antibiotic treatments for diseases that afflict principally third world countries. I think at the end of the day, he's a scientist and he's a physician and he's not a murderer.
Well, and yet, as you said, I mean, $6 million, that might make you feel a little better about being hounded like that. 2 years of watching people talk about him on television while he sat in a room, you know, his girlfriend's apartment. Does the $6 million erase that?
I don't know if the money that he got from the government is ever going to heal those wounds, and I think he would be the first to acknowledge that. He has a very keen distrust today of virtually everyone. He purposely avoids, for example, post offices because he doesn't want to be accused of any sort of surreptitious mailings. He uses credit cards wherever he goes so that he can document his whereabouts if he ever needs an alibi. These are not the activities of someone who has led a normal life. They are the activities of someone who I think you could safely say was unfairly persecuted and now will suffer from that persecution for the rest of his life. Is that worth $6 million? You tell me.
David Fried's story about the suspect in the anthrax letters is called The Wrong Man. It appears in the May issue of The Atlantic, and you can read it at our website, herenow.org. David Fried, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Still ahead today, a look back at In Living Color, the groundbreaking TV show, and a look ahead. What will be the ramifications of today's decision that the first wind farm will be built off of Cape Cod? We'll have some of that in the latest news as well. That's next, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Charles River Apparel, over a quarter century of creating apparel for corporations and athletic teams, based in New England and family-owned, on Facebook at facebook.com/Charles River Apparel, and the Institute of Contemporary Art on Boston's waterfront, presenting the work of a diverse range of contemporary artists, performers, and more, icaboston.org.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, the Obama administration has given the okay for the country's first wind farm to be built between Cape Cod and Nantucket Island here in Massachusetts. A reporter was at the press conference today. We'll have a report. But first, we go much further south, where police in South Florida are on the lookout for women who target men, spike their drinks, and rob them. The victims are mostly men in their 50s and 60s who report waking up and finding their expensive Rolex watches, for instance, missing, along with cash and credit cards. Michael LaForgia is with the Palm Beach Post. Michael, you've been reporting on this in your area. And this morning, the Today Show showed two women down in South Beach, Miami, caught on video camera using a man's credit card while he was drugged and sleeping in a cab waiting at the curb. So first of all, do we know if these incidents are connected?
Robin, they're not ruling that out. What they've got so far, at least the authorities up here in Palm Beach County, are looking at 10 different cases. Seven of those are active, and three are cases in which the people came forward but didn't want to file reports.
Well, and that's another question. Do we know how widespread this is?
So far, the authorities that I've spoken to have only connected these sorts of incidents to the three counties that make up South Florida.
Because we're hearing that a lot of these men that this happens to don't want to report it. They're embarrassed. The men who appeared on the Today Show were in silhouette.
Right. And that's what happened in the three cases where men didn't want to file reports. There's a lot of reasons why someone might be hesitant to come forward.
Well, tell us about the example you write about, a woman at a marina.
On April 3rd, a woman who fit the description given by victims of a previous robbery in Boca Raton drugged and robbed a man aboard a boat at the Sailfish Marina in Palm Beach Shores, which is just north of West Palm Beach.
Did she actually get on his boat?
She did. She spent a couple hours on his boat. As a matter of fact, witnesses said they reported seeing her walking around the boat with no sign of the guy for quite some time after the robbery apparently took place.
And what was he robbed of?
She apparently stole $16,000 in jewelry from him, including a high-end watch.
He's lucky he didn't lose the boat. this has been played as somewhat comical, but it could get serious quickly. What are police saying about their concerns?
Well, obviously the police are concerned that these women are going to overdo it with one of these men, give him too much of an incapacitating drug, and kill him.
Yeah. And of course, we know that there's a parallel reality here, that women have long been drugged by the so-called date rape drugs. Very serious concerns there. But are there other areas and other times when this has happened?
I don't know any that I've experienced or that I've covered myself, but I know I had spoken to a coworker the other day, and he mentioned to me that he had covered some similar stories maybe 10 or 15 years ago in the same area. So I don't think it's that unusual.
A new idea. And we're also hearing that there was a suspected ring in Austin, Texas, doing the same thing. Well, are people being warned about this? Are police, you know, you said police are concerned, but are they telling people how to avoid it? And how are people in the area reacting to it?
Well, law enforcement agencies have come forward, Palm Beach Shores Police in particular, to, you know, stress the importance of being careful, of keeping your guard, especially if you're out, you're an older guy between the age of 50 and 60, and, you know, you're wearing a glitzy watch. They're saying that, you know, don't take drinks from women, kind of basically the opposite of what women usually hear. Women are usually told about men in bars.
So it's sort of, you know, the tables have turned in this story. And with that in mind, are the men that this has happened to, are, you know, are people blaming the men or, you know?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you know, you can make your own moral judgments about something, but just because a guy makes a bad decision doesn't mean he deserves to have $15,000 in jewelry taken from him.
Well, there you go. Michael LaForgia, a reporter with the Palm Beach Post. Michael, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, let's take a look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, a scholar with an idea for Haiti and other countries with homeless populations. Build them charter cities in host countries like Brazil. Think Hong Kong. Also, a Louisiana oyster farmer who's preparing for the worst as that oil spill heads towards the Gulf Coast. That's all tomorrow. Still ahead today, we'll speak with the president of the Cape Wind Project on his big win today, the Obama administration giving the go-ahead for his project to be built. That's in 30 seconds, Here and Now. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar today approved the first offshore wind project in the U.S. Salazar gave Cape Wind the okay to build a 130-turbine wind farm in Nantucket Sound. This would be between Cape Cod and Nantucket Island, and it would provide three-quarters of the power for Cape Cod. At the Massachusetts State House today, Secretary Salazar said he listened to all sides in the debate before making his decision.
I am convinced that there is a path we can take forward that both honors our responsibility to protect the historic and cultural resources of Nantucket Sound, and at the same time meets the needs to repower our economy with clean energy produced from wind power.
The late Senator Ted Kennedy had led the opposition to the project, saying the wind farm would damage tourism, hurt recreational boating, harm wildlife, and disrupt commercial fishing. Here now is Kurt Nikisch is at the Mass State House. And Kurt, Secretary Salazar approved the project with a couple of caveats. What are those?
Well, a couple of them were old. I mean, they were things that we already sort of suspected were going to happen because they were on the table. That was decreasing the number of wind turbines from 170 down to 130 and sort of changing the orientation so that you can't see them as well from land. This area would be about 5 miles offshore, but still visible. Mm-hmm. But what's really new is that he asked the developer to conduct new sort of marine archaeological surveys of the area where all these wind turbines would go in. And that's because, a few thousand years ago, this area used to be above land, and it was when Native American tribes that still live in the area would have used this. So there's some question whether or not any of this could have old burial grounds. There's no indication of that at this point, but they're going to make the developer take a harder look at the territory. And then the other thing is they're going to require some sort of negotiation to offer these affected American Indian tribes some sort of mitigation. It's not clear whether or not they're going to accept it or go through with the negotiation, but there could very well be some sort of financial compensation for these tribes for this, you know, sort of impingement on this traditional cultural area of their ancestors.
Well, Kurt, by the way, we have the developer, Jim Gordon, on the line. We'll get to him in just a couple seconds, but we understand he was also asked to take steps to make the turbines less visible?
Yeah, and that's just the number and directions that we already knew about and had been talked about, but this is now final today that they're going to have to do that.
So less of them. I thought by less visible it might have meant somehow disguising them or something. But
There has been a lot of talk about what color to paint these to sort of blend them in. They need to be visible, but they also, don't need to be too visible. So
it might be a color choice.
Right.
Here now is Kurt Nikisch at the Mass State House, where Secretary Salazar today approved the Cape Wind project. Kurt, thanks so much.
Sure thing.
Jim Gordon is founder of Cape Wind. He joins us on the line. And Jim, first of all, your reaction.
Well, this is a tremendous day for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. It's really going to put us on the path to a more sustainable energy future. And we really will have an opportunity to exercise global leadership in the offshore renewable energies business. The success of this project, we believe, is going to attract other companies and other technology spin-offs around the offshore wind industry. So we're very excited today and grateful for Secretary Salazar's decision, as well as Governor Patrick's support.
That's the Governor Deval Patrick here in Massachusetts. Well, Secretary Salazar said that he felt it did take too long for Cape Wind for you to get your approval, 9 years, and that seems to indicate that other offshore projects might get up and running a little faster. But what do you say? You know how emotional this debate has been here in this area, Jim. We've spoken to you before. People who were behind you, backing you, said that whatever trade-offs there were worth it. And when you look at oil spills that we're seeing now, they are even more reinforced in that idea. But others felt that the wind farm will be harmful to marine life, will destroy some of the tourism. They'll be seen. They're right in the path that the ferry takes from Cape Cod to Nantucket. So they will be visual harm to an area that's been so pristine. What do you say to people after this very bruising fight?
Well, we're reaching out to, the local opponents who have opposed the project, and we've worked very hard over the last 9 years to ensure that Cape Wind will peacefully coexist on this very shallow shoal, 7 miles from Hyannis, 13 miles from Nantucket, and 9 miles from Edgartown. But as you pointed out, Robin, it's not a choice between Cape Wind and nothing. The electric demand in southern New England is rapidly growing. The alternative choices are, do we build more coal, oil, and nuclear power plants, or do we start to move forward on a more sustainable energy path with projects like Cape Wind?
But, Jim, I'm just going to jump in to ask you about that because you mentioned sustainable. An energy analyst today told the New York Times we shouldn't be developing offshore wind farms because there's so many land sites, and offshore is still so expensive. The U.S. Offshore Wind Collaborative issued a report last year saying offshore wind energy is still about $4,600 a kilowatt, and that includes installation. Very, very expensive. So, why is this even a good business venture? You've still got to raise, I think, $2 billion just to build it.
Well, Robin, when you recognize that, 27 coastal states consume over 73% of the energy in the United States, and the fact that these are land-constrained and densely populated areas, the renewable resource that they have and can harness is offshore wind. And although you point out that the capital cost of offshore wind is high, and it is, but the point is there's no fuel cost. And if you consider the price of oil and gas rapidly increasing over the coming decades, we believe that offshore wind is going to be a significant value to electricity consumers in the region. And most importantly, when you recognize that the Cape and Islands, being a low-lying coastal community and most susceptible to the impacts of climate change, I'm talking about more intense and frequent hurricanes, rising sea levels, ocean acidification. This is a project that is actually going to help enhance and preserve the environment of the Cape and Islands. And these are not my words. These are the words of 17 federal and state regulatory agencies that looked at every aspect of this project.
Jim Gordon, founder of Cape Wind. Today he won a nine-year battle to build a 130-turbine wind farm off the coast of Cape Cod. Turbines more than 40 stories tall, bigger than the Statue of Liberty. But as he says, he got permission from the Obama administration because the feeling is it is the way of the future. Jim Gordon, thanks. I know we're going to talk to you again as this goes along. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
We'll be back in 1 minute, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back. 20 years ago this month, the sketch comedy show In Living Color hit the airwaves, and the airwaves were never the same. The relatively new Fox Television Network took a risk with the show, which featured edgy humor, like this Men on Film skit with Damon Wayans and David Alan Greer playing stereotypically over-the-top gay film reviewers.
Hello, I'm Blaine Edwards.
And I'm Antoine Mayweather.
And welcome to Men on Films. The show that looks at movies
from a male point of view.
Tonight we'll be wrapping up the summer films. First up is the box office smash, Total Recall.
Yes, this is the movie where muscle-bound Arnold Schwarzenegger goes searching his past. Just a hint, Arnold, try looking in the closet. Next we have Betsy's Wedding.
Hated it.
Damon Wayans and his brother Keenan were the show's co-creators. In Living Color served as a launching pad for them and their siblings, but also Jamie Foxx, Jennifer Lopez, and Jim Carrey. Who could forget Jim Carrey's pyromaniac burn victim fire marshal Bill? Here now, pop culture expert Renee Graham joins us. Renee, welcome.
Hi, Robin.
And I know you've said that the Men on Films skit was one of your favorites. But what was so fresh about it? Take us back, way back to 1990.
You know, TV had pretty much fallen into a rut, and suddenly you had the Fox Network, which at that time was only 4 years old as a television network, which was looking for its own audience. They didn't have this access to the stars. They didn't have the same kind of money, so they just decided to create shows that would attract sort of a hip, offbeat audience, and that's when they started creating shows like In Living Color.
And this isn't the Fox TV we talk about today. This is more Fox Films. This show was made on the Fox Films lot out in Los Angeles.
Exactly. This was the network of, you know, Married with Children, 21 Jump Street, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, and so we hear this skit, and for somebody today who, you know, maybe had never heard the show, they may be horrified. Oh my God, who are they putting down? The list is so long. What were they doing with the show?
It was after years of Saturday Night Live, and I think they wanted to create something that was even more irreverent. But in having a predominantly black cast, what they were able to do was concentrate on skits that a predominantly white cast like Saturday Night Live could never get away with.
Well, and let's listen to one, because the show took on black icons like Oprah. Here's Kim Wayans as Oprah in a skit that takes place in Oprah's restaurant, and Kim Wayans has extra padding in her costume, and she's basically eating her way through the entire skit. Let's listen.
Hello! We must be celebrating something special tonight.
Well, we sure are. We've just become engaged.
Oh, girlfriend engaged?
Yes.
So you set a date?
Well, no, not yet. But
sometime soon.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Girlfriend, let Oprah school you. That is the oldest trick in the book.
Really?
Honey, a man will use you up. He will lay up in your house. He will spend up your money. He'll live in your condo. And you will never, ever see that gold band on your finger.
Kim Wayans as Oprah on In Living Color. And Renee, this reportedly upset Oprah.
It upset Oprah. I mean, lots of people were upset who were the subject of satires on that show. If you were popular enough in those days, you were going to be a target, especially in some cases if you were a black celebrity. So they sent up Oprah. They sent up Arsenio Hall. That was the nature of the show. There wasn't anything that was off limits as far as they were concerned.
Well, Kim Wayans has said that since then she regrets those Oprah skits because she thought they were too mean-spirited. And there were a couple that just did go too far.
No, just to say, were the Oprah skits mean-spirited? Yes, but almost everything they did was mean-spirited. But occasionally they did go much, much too far. There were several instances, especially with the Men on Film skit, which they began to broaden out into different horizons. So they had Men on Football, which aired as a special Super Bowl halftime special, a live version of the Men on Film skit.
They let them on TV live.
They let them on TV live. And look, I think the producers knew exactly what they were doing. They got a huge audience out of it, but the ad-libbing by the two actors, Damon Wayans and David Alan Greer, went into a certain area and sort of accused certain celebrities of being gay, and it made people nuts. I mean, but that was a live show. That's what they expected to get. They wanted to get that kind of electricity on the air.
One of the actors they made insinuations about was Richard Gere. That segment was cut from reruns and DVDs.
Although it is available on YouTube.
Okay. One of the most popular characters on In Living Color had to be Homie the Clown.
The world's angriest clown.
Damon Wayans played Homie as Santa Claus, and here he is catching one of the kids trying to steal something.
If you need a toy, I can't afford one, Homie Claus can give you one. I got money. I stole it so I can be in a gang. It's part of my initiation.
Well, I guess since it's Christmas, I should let you off with just a warning, huh?
I don't think so. Homie, don't play that.
I don't think so. Homie, don't play that. It became a catchphrase in the culture.
Everyone was saying it. People still say it, and I'm not even necessarily sure they know where it originated.
Well, in fact, the African-American online news site The Root wrote that many of the protesters at the town hall healthcare meetings this past summer carried signs saying, "Homie, don't play that," and The Root suggesting that they may not know where that slogan comes from.
I think that's entirely possible. You know, this is a show that ran from 1990 to 1995, and I don't necessarily know that the Tea Party protesters were necessarily fans of In Living Color, so I think it's just one of those expressions that made its way into the culture. Now they're using it for their own purposes, but they have no idea where it came from, and they know nothing about the character who originally said it.
Jamie Foxx was on the show. Here he is as Wanda. Basically, not good looking.
Not the prettiest flower in the garden, shall we say.
But she, however, does not see herself this way. In this scene, her friends are trying to set her up with a male version of herself, and she, of course, thinks she's too good for him.
Baby, you smell good. What you wearing? Speed stick? Your eyes are so beautiful.
I know this. Why don't you go be a victim of a drive-by or something?
You know, Wanda, looks aren't everything. I think he's actually quite smart.
Well, if he's so smart, how come he can't cure ugliness?
Renee, wasn't Living Color misogynistic?
Yes. It was also racist. It was also homophobic. But here was the thing. The key to what the Wayans wanted to do was to create a show that was going to be offensive but also funny. In a lot of ways, it owed a lot to Mel Brooks, and in particular, Blazing Saddles. When the idea was you can take an offensive topic and you could send it up in a way that's just funny. That even if you're offended, you'll still find the humor in it.
He even used the N-word in Blazing Saddles.
Constantly in Blazing Saddles, and it's still one of the funniest movies ever made.
So is there anything, Renee, that's doing that kind of humor, sending up black icons and black stereotypes in particular, today?
Not on network television. I mean, that's a big key here. You can certainly find those things on places on the internet that produce their own original content, and perhaps we might get back to that kind of thing on pay cable. But I don't think network television is ever going to go there. You're never going to have two flamboyantly gay black men reviewing film and at the same time making, you know, lots and lots of sexual innuendo. I just don't see that ever happening on network television again.
And if you could bring back In Living Color today, what issues would you like to see the show take on?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, people always sort of wondered, well, you know, the show was sort of taking on issues and it was sending up stereotypes. I never thought they sent up stereotypes at all. I think they reveled in the stereotypes. I don't think they were trying to teach us anything. I think all they wanted to do was make people laugh. I think a lot of the things that they dealt with are still relevant. I think they're, you know, with politicians and some of the celebrities we have now, it's a gold mine. If Living Color were to come back today, they would have an untold number of things to make fun of.
Well, and an African-American president.
An African-American president. It could mine a lot of comedy, I have no doubt.
Come to think of it, the character who does Barack Obama on Saturday Night Live, is he black?
No.
Yeah.
Well, Fred Armistead.
If you had In Living Color,
you could actually have a black actor playing the first black president. Yes. What a novel idea.
Here now, pop culture expert Renee Graham on the 20th anniversary this month of the 90s sketch comedy show In Living Color. Renee, thanks as always.
Thanks, Robin.
You up all the moon float like a balloon. You see, it's never too late and it's never too soon. Take it from me, it's I to be
in living color.
And how would you feel knowing prejudice was obsolete and all mankind danced to the exact beat? and at night it was safe to walk down the street.
In living color.
Yours or what's yours is mine.
In living color.
And how would you feel knowing everybody?